Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome once again. So our tradition is at this time to go around and introduce ourselves, and then I'll get to introduce our speaker. So let me start with myself. My name is Oswaldo.
My name is Paul.
Stuart.
My name is Roy.
Stephen.
My name is David.
Rob.
Brian.
Yeah.
I'm Brad.
Grisha.
Peter.
I'm Al.
I'm Bob.
I think we've got everybody. Yeah. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dhammadasa Dhammachari. Yeah. Dhammachari? Yeah.
Dhammadasa.
This is the fourth and final talk or series that's been centered on, I guess the overall title would be the Taste of Freedom and the Wisdom of the Body. Today is, as I mentioned, the final one, and it's a big topic, a universe imbued with compassion. So, welcome.
Thank you, Oswaldo. As Oswaldo was saying, this is the final talk in this 4-week series. And we'll be talking today about a universe imbued with compassion. And I'll also be synthesizing a number of the points that we've been talking about this entire week. But the first thing I'd like to start with is, for those of you who have been here during these past 3 weeks, at the end of each session, I've been suggesting these practice commitments, and adding a couple practice commitments as we've gone, as we progress through the month. You know, to meditate more, to ask this question of what else is there, what am I not seeing, what is the shape of my mind, and for week two, the suggestion to do nothing, to go for a walk with no destination. Someone mentioned that they were doing this practice of taking 3 deep breaths. And then the commitment that I suggested at the end of last week was this practice of perfuming the mind, really perfuming the body, heart, and mind. And this here is pointing at the use of slogans, just simple little phrases that can shift our consciousness, open things up, see things in a different way. And in this life, I suggested a few slogans that, that are quite meaningful to me, these three in particular. This is a direct quote from the Buddha. It appears in multiple times in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha will say this: this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And I like to reframe this as, not my circus, not my monkeys, pointing at the same thing. And this here, I'm going to be saying a lot more about this. With Amitabha Buddha, we can leave the past behind. This particular phrase is very close to my heart, and I'll be saying more about that. And another thing that we can do to perfume our minds is actually with poetry. You know, something that strikes us, that opens our hearts, that makes us pause and see things, take things in a different way. So, I was wondering if anyone engaged in any of these practice commitments, or even thought about it and didn't, and if anyone would like to share anything about their experience. Stefan.
On the go for a walk without with no destination,
I did that, and it was basically just observing things as I walked, as opposed to just going for a destination. And then after last week, it came to mind, oh, I've heard it said a different way. It's like, it's not the destination, it's the journey, as a slogan. And I was at an Al-Anon meeting last week, and one of the readings was, recovery is a journey, not a destination. And so it was kind of, oh, this whole theme of, you know, the process and not really looking at where you're going or what the end point would be.
Mm. Thank you, Stefan.
I wasn't here, but I would love to just take a snapshot of this.
Oh, yes, you're more than welcome to.
I really liked it, and I just want to take it with me.
Now, David.
Yeah. So, I'm in the middle of a move after being here for 30 years. And it's bringing up all sorts of fear and issues around security. And so I constantly, you know, notice the fear, notice my issues, and I ask the question, what am I not seeing? You know, I think we talked about kind of, can't remember how you phrased it, but we all have certain patterns, and I call them my greatest hits that I go to over and over the years, and certainly security is one of them. So, I try to look at it and notice it and try to reframe it in another way or see what I'm missing.
Mm.
Where am I not seeing?
Oh, thank you, David. And what was your name again?
Rob. So I don't know if it's a combination of this and also doing a mindfulness-based stress reduction class right now. And in the last week, it hit me sort of like over the head that the city all of a sudden seemed much more crowded. More traffic, more people on the street, more noise. And it was different.
Hmm. Hmm.
And I don't know if that's, you know, stepping back and looking at things differently or just being more aware. I don't know.
Hmm. Well, it's quite interesting, you know, how our minds will tend to see what we want to see. So, for example, take homelessness, for example. For me, I'll speak for myself in terms of homeless people. Homeless people are, I tend to look away when I see homeless people. And I tend to keep homeless people out at the fringes of my consciousness. And a close friend of mine is actually very actively involved in homeless advocacy. And whenever I get together with this particular friend, it just really brings something to life in my psyche that these are actually real people. Real. And then the next day, I suddenly see homeless people everywhere. It's very interesting. You know, so again, this whole process of directing the mind is wherever we choose to direct our mind, it will tend to amplify that which we are looking at, or perhaps looking for. Yeah. It's very interesting just watching this mind kind of narrow down and expand. Would anyone else like to share anything? And Grisha?
I wasn't here last week, but I appreciate the phrase perfume mind. One of my practices to read from several daily meditation books in the morning when I get up, and I read it. I've been reading Mark Nepo, Emma Chodron, and Tara Brach. And I basically read until something strikes me, and then I highlight it, and then I text it to a couple of friends.
Mm.
And it's just like I wake up loud negative bias every day, fear and anxiety. And so that always, I love that. It just perfumes the mind, so that it redirects my thinking, at least while I'm reading.
Yes. thank you, Grisha. Yes. And I see we're joined by one more person. Hi, sir. What is your name?
What am I doing?
No, what is your name?
Oh, my name's Paul.
Well, Paul. And what are you doing? Well, Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Sorry to be late.
Oh, that's quite all right. Okay, so now we're going to move into
this week's topic. And it is... to go back to this slide here and say a bit more about this. So I think I put this up on the second week, and I came back to it last week, and now I'd like to really kind of tie this all together. So what I've written here on this slide is on the left-hand side, I've got these three great schools of Buddhism which unfolded chronologically. You know, so the first school being the Theravadin, also referred to as the Hinayana, that which you predominantly find in the Pali Canon. And that was followed by the Mahayana tradition, which is characterized by lots of phantasmagorical stories of archetypal worlds and all sorts of crazy stuff going on in the Mahayana. And that was followed by the Vajrayana. Yeah, I'll say a bit more about the Vajrayana approach. And then on the right here, I've just written down in pink here three different ways of thinking about these three great schools. So Mesa the Theravadin, it says self-development or self-discipline, the path of self-development. In Mahayana, we transition into the path of self-surrender. And in the Vajrayana, we arrive, if you will, at the path of self-discovery. Self-development, self-surrender, self-discovery. And last week I wrote down here, beneath this point here about the Mahayana, two questions. The question of surrender what? This idea of surrendering, how something needs to be surrendered. And surrender into what? So when we do surrender, then what? And then beneath here, this path of self-discovery and the Vajrayana, I've just written a slightly different question of what is discovered around self-discovery? What specifically is discovered?
Now, Buddhism is also referred to as the middle way. And in applying the middle way to this particular way of framing practice, the middle way represents a blending of these three different approaches. A middle way suggests that if we rely too heavily on any one of these particular approaches, we may end up lacking well-roundedness in our practice. We may come up against something that feels perhaps insurmountable. And perhaps when we arrive at that place, a different approach is needed. A different approach is called for. So it's very helpful to have these three different approaches in our toolbox, knowledge of these three different approaches, and sort of to know when it's appropriate to use one versus the other, to know what is present and what is not, how to blend these approaches together. So I'd like to say something about each one of these approaches. So in terms of this path of self-development or self-discipline, I'd said earlier in the month that you will find this approach very much so in the Pali Canon. And the example that I used was from the Dhammapada, which is a little book of sayings of the Buddha, where you will find this language of restraining the mind, a well-trained mind, a disciplined mind. And the Buddha will juxtapose these images of a mind which is untamed and a mind which is tamed. And the implication here is that we actually need to apply effort to first discern clearly what is wise and what is unwise, and we need to apply energy to make good decisions, to move us towards freedom and move us away from suffering. It's a very broad brushstroke. This is the path of self-development, self-discipline. Now, I also spoke about this idea that sometimes ourselves are not the most reliable sources of clear seeing, if you will. Because these selves, this me, is immersed in greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a bit of a paradox. How can I, who am immersed in greed, hatred, and delusion, see clearly? Well, it's kind of an interesting question. So in terms of my own path of practice, and those many people I know, many people just arrive with Buddhist practice with this mindset of self-development and self-discipline. I mean, really, this is one of our cultural inheritances in this modern world, is we are all engaged in this process of becoming better people, becoming better workers, just becoming better. We're in this process of productivity, something. We're constantly going, we're constantly striving, moving towards something. So people take quite well to this idea of self-development. And in my practice, I certainly did that for many years, this path of self-development. And I need to make better choices. I need to not do this, and I need to do this instead. And that actually worked very well for a number of years for me. I definitely experienced myself becoming a kinder person, a more patient person. The edges got smoothed out. When I would explode in anger, rather than that anger lingering for days or weeks, it would linger for much less time. So there was a lot of very positive movement associated with this particular way of approaching practice. And at some point, I just got this sense that, is that it? There must be more. I actually arrived at a place where I felt as if I could not make further progress on my own. I felt like I had just come up against some sort of a plateau, some sort of a wall, something there that I couldn't quite put my finger on. So it was very interesting, this process of giving up, if you will. This process of, kind of reevaluating what practice is about, what it means to me, and how to make practice effective for me. And this enters into the realm of self-surrender. So self-surrender involves looking beyond me, this tiny self, for guidance. Self-surrender is pointing at looking towards the grace and wisdom of all the Buddhas for direction, for guidance, relying upon the grace and wisdom of all the Buddhas. So we can surrender to something that's beyond the self. And, Stefan, you mentioned being in an Al-Anon meeting. So I think it's very fascinating in the anonymous community that in that teaching, you've got it right there, this idea of surrendering to a higher power, right? Surrendering to God, God being whatever that means to you. This is very interesting, this thing of surrendering, of recognizing that relying on ourselves is perhaps not the best strategy all the time. That there is something else that we can rely upon, something quite beautiful. And then when we enter into this Vajrayana approach of self-discovery, now, of course, self-discovery, It's a little play on words there. What is discovered? So what is discovered? So I will just simply quote some Tibetan teachers. They will speak about the intrinsic purity of the mind, the inherent and intrinsic goodness of our hearts and minds, that we are already enlightened. It's just that we've forgotten, we've lost contact with this inherent beauty that lies within us. And the path of practice is to realize this, is to remove these veils, if you will, to remove this dust from our eyes so that we may see our inherent beauty, our inherent purity clearly, so that may shine through. So what is discovered is that the self, there's much more going on than the self. Other, self, other, that they're in fact just one and the same, if you will. That these distinctions from the perspective of the purified mind, actually they have no meaning, self and other. There's this idea of this exchange of self and other within the Vajrayana approach. And I quite love this. There's this one little saying that a Tibetan teacher who I'm particularly fond of, he says this, if you're wondering about this, if you'd like to just get a glimpse of this intrinsic purity of mind, all you need to do is look in the gaps between your thoughts. The gaps between your thoughts. There it is. So this approach, the Vajrayana approach, it actually makes this liberated experience, this experience of freedom, it makes it feel very close at hand, like it's there, it's there, it's there, it's always there. All we have to do is pay attention and we'll recognize it. So in terms of how these three approaches support each other, complement each other, and are actually, I will say, are necessary, all three of these approaches, to blend them together in whatever way works for us. So in terms of this path of self-discipline, I can say this for myself, I am my toughest critic. And I know a lot of other people who will nod their heads at this idea of I am my toughest critic. So this path of self-discipline and self-development, it can, there's a danger of that path lacking kindness. We can sort of beat ourselves up about it. We can tend to see what's wrong much more so than seeing what's positive. I know that I have this tendency internally, is I will tend to amplify that which is wrong, and I will tend to de-emphasize that which is positive in any given situation. I have to remind myself to see the goodness in any given situation. So the self-development, it's not necessarily reliable. Requires a lot of effort. So around self-surrender and self-discovery, these two paths, if we rely too heavily on these things, we can actually fall into this trap of what is referred to as like spiritual laziness. Well, I don't have to do anything. I can just, I'm already enlightened. I just have to notice it. I'll just sit here and everything will be fine. We can become passive in this sort of approach. In terms of self-surrendering, we can become passive in a way, giving our power away to some other power. There's a lot there. So this path of self-surrender and self-discovery are very much supported by this path of self-discovery. I'll tell you a little story here, and this story is from the Japanese Pure Land tradition. It's called Jodo Shinshu, means the true word, Jodo Shinshu. And this particular way of practicing is a Mahayana approach. It's about self-surrender. And this is one of my homes, one of my practice homes. So in this tradition, this particular tradition, it was founded by this Japanese saint. His name is Shinran. And in the historical record, he's referred to as Shinran Shonin. So Shonen translates as saint, Shinran the saint. It was very interesting because Shinran, he most certainly would have objected to being called a saint. Because when he was alive, he used to sign his written correspondences with Shinran Gotoku. And what this word Gotoku means the hairy one. Shinran the hairy one. And whenever anybody tried to call him teacher or call him a saint or an enlightened master, his response to these people would be, "No, no, no, I'm no saint, I'm not enlightened. Do not rely on me, for I am a foolish being. I'm filled with greed, hatred, and delusion. Instead, you should rely on the grace of all the Buddhas." This is what Shinran taught. I am a foolish being. So the primary practice in this tradition is the recitation of a particular mantra. It is called the Nembutsu. And this word Nembutsu poetically translates as the name that calls, the Nembutsu. And the Nembutsu is simply a chant. And this chant is Namu Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu. So Shinran and his teacher Honen, it is said that they used to do this chant, and they would do it constantly. They would do it 40, 50,000 times a day, just constantly doing this chant. Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu. And Shinran, he was exiled from the capital at the time, from the capital of Kyoto. So he traveled around the countryside of Japan, the villages, these small villages, and he would teach this to fishmongers and prostitutes and gamblers and drunkards. He would teach to anybody. And he would say to these people, you know, in terms of being a Buddhist, in terms of gaining freedom and enlightenment, you don't need to be a monastic practitioner. You don't need to shave your heads. You don't need to meditate for 10 hours a day. You don't need to study the holy scriptures. Matter of fact, you don't even need to know how to read. You don't need to change your profession. You don't need to. All you have to do is have faith. Have faith in the grace of all the Buddhas. And if you just simply do this chant, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, you will find salvation. This is what he taught. Now this gets very quickly mixed up with salvation in the Judeo-Christian sense of salvation. Now again, this comes back to our cultural conditioning here in the West. So, when we think of these words, faith, devotion, some people's hearts may open, some people's hearts may resonate with that. But there's also, a more dominant response to those of us who are not affiliated with the Judeo-Christian tradition, is, I would say, the response is more predominantly one of, "Oh, I don't know about that." It's much more cautious, much more skeptical, much more, "That's not really my cup of tea." So there's definitely some cultural conditioning which needs to be closely examined to enter into more fully this path of self-surrender. So I'd like to tell you a little story of self-surrender. There's two stories. The first one is actually from the Vajrayana tradition. So in the path of the Vajrayana, in the Tibetan tradition in particular, the guru is of primary importance. The guru, and then the guru-disciple relationship. Now, this particular model does not map well into our modern-day culture. So we'll just set that aside. The guru-disciple. So what is said in this particular tradition is that the guru is an enlightened master, and the guru is in direct contact with this liberated mind, this big mind, the Dharmakaya, whatever you want to call it. The guru is in touch with, is in direct contact with something far greater, something far more mysterious than what we see here with our normal waking consciousness. And then as a disciple, when we are in relationship with the guru, when we are in contact with the guru, then by extension, we are also in contact with this great mysterious unfolding, what is referred to as the Dharmakaya. So I've once had this experience of being at the foot of, bowing before the feet of a Tibetan guru, and just feeling this sense of presence, this sense of someone who is just radiating pure love. Now perhaps I'm just projecting that onto this individual. I don't really know. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. So here's a second story about self-surrender. And this is quite a well-known story from the life of the Buddha. The Buddha, when he was training, he practiced with these five ascetics before he became enlightened. And ascetic practice was very well known at the time of the Buddha. It's actually still practiced today. And ascetic practice involves denying the body of all sensual experience. You know, sensual experience in terms of comfort, denying the body. So ascetic practices can look like, basically eating one grain of rice a day, or, ascetic practice can look like sitting in the hot sun in front of a huge fire, just sitting there. Or ascetic practice can be, these practices where people will stand. Yeah, they'll just stand. Never sit down, never lie down. A lot of kind of, what's going on with that? So he practiced with these five ascetics for a number of years, and the Buddha became very, very accomplished as an ascetic practitioner. And you will sometimes come across these images of the Buddha, or of Siddhartha, the Buddha to be, and rather than these sort of glowing images, you will see these images of the Buddha to be completely emaciated, just thinned out cheeks. You can see the ribs and everything. It's quite striking images. So the Buddha went down this path of asceticism, of complete denial, and realized that this was not the right path. So then he began to eat, and his ascetics abandoned him. And then the Buddha then discovered enlightenment. And after he discovered enlightenment, he thought to himself, who can I share this with? And he chose to seek out his five former ascetic companions and teach them. So he went to go see them. And this is a part of the story I quite love, right? The five ascetics, they see the Buddha approaching. They look, and they think he's given up. They think he's gone for a life of luxury because he started eating again. Mm-hmm. So they all decide, oh, let's not talk to him. Let's just ignore him. Let's not put out water for him so that he may wash his feet. Let's not put out any food for him. Let's not even greet him. And they all agree to do this because they think that the Buddha has copped out. So as the Buddha is approaching, and he enters into their space, all five of them, they immediately have a change of heart. They immediately forget their plan to ignore the Buddha. And they immediately bow before him. They immediately give him water to bathe his feet, bathe his hands. They immediately give him food. And they rejoice in his presence. And then the Buddha goes on to teach them, of course. But I quite like this moment where they've all decided, I want nothing to do with this guy. And there's something about the Buddha that causes them to have a change of heart, change of mind. It's very interesting to be in the presence of something so much more. We may not be able to name it. We may not even know what's going on, but we can feel it in our hearts. There's something there that opens up. So in terms of my own practice of the Nembutsu, Namo Amida Butsu, this here is my go-to slogan, Namo Amida Butsu. And I actually have a recording on my phone, this beautiful recording I found on the internet, and it sounds like a Gregorian chant. It's absolutely beautiful. And when I'm working, I will sometimes just pop my headphones in. And I'll just have this playing in the background, you know, kind of low volume, so it's not too distracting. It's just the sound of Namo Amida Butsu just running through my mind. It's there, it's perfuming the mind. So there's this lovely little story from this tradition that I'd like to share with you. The name that calls, Nembutsu. Namo Amida Butsu, the name that calls. So let me take one step back and talk about the Tibetan practices known as sadhana, which is kind of loosely translated as visualization. So it's very common in the Tibetan tradition for practitioners to receive a sadhana practice. And a sadhana practice will involve a protector deity. When one is given one of these practices, one then engages in this visualization practice, this imaginative visualization practice. So when I was ordained, I received a sadhana practice. And very broadly, broad brushstrokes, it involves visualize the blue sky, a lotus opening up, a moon mat, and visualize your protector deity, and then this all dissolves back into the blue sky. So in terms of the Nembutsu, Namo Amida Butsu, the name that calls, for me, there is something much more instantaneous about it. I feel as if Amida Butsu is constantly with me. Namo Amida Butsu. So it's said, and when doing the Nembutsu, is that doing the Nembutsu is a bit like it's like your lifeline. It's your one phone call, you know, when you're on the game show. So when I'm feeling really bent out of shape, frustrated, I'm not getting what I want, blah 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 blah, all of that, I can just simply call upon Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu. And in this, when I say Namo Amida Butsu, I carry with that the meaning. I add to that this meaning of, you know, I'm kind of having a little rough time down here. I could use a little help. And this is what's said about the practice, the name that calls, Namo Amida Butsu. When I say this, I also simultaneously hear myself saying this, Namo Amida Butsu. And what the tradition says about this is what we hear is actually Amida Butsu's instantaneous response. So when I call upon Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, Amida Butsu instantaneously appears in my mind's eye and instantaneously responds, and I can hear that response, Namo Amida Butsu. And this is Amida Butsu saying to me, stay calm and carry on. This is Amida Butsu saying to me, not your circus, not your monkeys. This is Amida Butsu granting me the power of vision, whatever you want to call it, of kindness, of patience, of understanding, the power of just letting go, just completely shifts my consciousness with this Namo Amida Butsu. So my own sadhana practice, I don't do this intricate visualization. As a matter of fact, I quite remember a number of years ago, perhaps it's the last time I did this visualization formally, is I was on a solitary retreat and I started doing this practice, this visualization practice. And about halfway through it, I thought to myself, what the hell are you doing? This does not speak to my heart, this visualization practice. And I just, and in this moment, I just realized for myself that it's this way of practicing the Nembutsu that is alive for me. So I very much feel that I do have a protector deity, Namo Amida Butsu, Amida Butsu, who is constantly with me and constantly reminding me of what is most important, constantly reminding me of what the right choice is in any given situation. So this is the path of self-surrender. I have surrendered to the grace and the wisdom of Amida Butsu. I have surrendered to a higher power. So I'd like to just take a few more minutes to talk about barriers to entering into this way of practicing. And these barriers really have to do with cultural conditioning. In our scientific, materialistic world, where information is at our fingertips, and fact, scientific fact, if you will, has much greater weight than myth and archetype. So there's a couple of objections which are raised in terms of practicing this way. Well, that's just pure fantasy. You're just making that up. It's not real. So in regards to this idea that it's pure fantasy, yes, it's pure fantasy. And so is everything else. What are you talking about? I've got kids. My kids aren't pure fantasy. I've got a job. I've got a house. What are you talking about? So this is the interesting thing about approaching these wisdom teachings. Is we can view them from the perspective of our normal waking consciousness, and we will end up with all these, that makes no sense. And it can simultaneously make sense from a much larger perspective. Or perhaps just we can be at ease with the nonsense of all of it. Maybe it makes no sense at all, it doesn't really matter. But just to be at ease with it. So pure fantasy. So according to the Buddhist tradition, everything is made by mind. Everything is led by mind. Everything is made by mind. everything.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good way to approach this? So I'm just going to briefly touch into Buddhist philosophy, if you will. Let's take a tree, for example. There is no way that we can directly experience this tree. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Well, what we experience when we experience a tree is we actually experience light entering our eyes, entering the rods and cones of our eyes. Photons, if you will. And then these photons become electrochemical signals that travel to our brain. And then our brain will then match this image that the mind creates with something called tree. And then we see that tree. It's kind of mysterious, actually, what we're actually seeing. So from a Buddhist perspective, from the Buddhist point of view, from the liberated mind, the perspective of the liberated mind, there is in fact no tree. And that which we see, that which we experience as a tree, is simply mind-made. So that's a bunch of philosophy. But now I'll go back to something much more down to earth, which is the stories we tell ourselves. So I'm sure we can all relate to this. I know I can in my experience. Is when this circus of the mind gets going, the crazy making of the mind, and we just look at our stories, our habitual ways of thinking, if we can just pause and take a couple steps back, we will very quickly notice that these stories tend to be grossly exaggerated. Yeah. That person never listens to me. That person, blah, blah, blah. Really? They never listen? That person's such a jerk, blah, blah. Really? Are they a jerk all the time? Is that all there is to that person? So we can see it, the way our minds create stories. And these stories have so much power over us. And they are made up. A lot of our stories are made up. Not everything. But there's a lot of our stories which we just make up. We just fill in all the blanks with whatever it is we want to see. We fabricate our experience. We just make it up. Much of the time. Sometimes, much of the time. I don't know. For me, it feels like I'm making up my story much of the time. So from this Buddhist perspective, well, knowing this, I like to call the mind a story-making machine. Knowing this, why not make up a story that's helpful? Why not? Why not make up a story that opens our hearts, opens our minds, allows us to enter into a new way of being, a new way of relating? So yes, it is pure fantasy. Is it real? Of course not. Does it really matter? Does it really matter? Is it true? Well, another interesting way to approach this is that if I imagine Amitabutsu appearing in my mind's eye, I could say, well, feels real to me. It's true enough. It's true to me. So this way of practicing self-surrender, archetypes, symbols, we're not talking about an objective reality. We're not talking about ultimate truths here. We're just talking about something very, very personal. The invitation here is to discover for ourselves that which resonates with our hearts. So I'd like to close with one final story. So in this Jodo Shinshu tradition, this Japanese Pure Land tradition, they use this rather clunky language of self-power and other power. And self-power is this path of self-discipline. Other power is self-surrender, relying on a power that's outside of us, something that's greater. And a very common, a very well-known image in the Buddhist tradition is the image of the raft, building a raft to get to the other shore symbolizing the liberated mind, and the raft as the Dharma, that which carries us across. And there's this lovely little story about building a raft. So let's say you wanted to travel to the other shore. What would you need to do? Well, you would need to build a raft. Well, let's say you didn't know how to build a raft. Well, you would have to learn that skill. You'd have to go find someone to teach you, and you'd have to develop that skill. You'd have to practice and build a raft that you felt was seaworthy. And then you would have to learn about navigation. You'd have to learn how to sail. You'd have to learn how to about provisions. There's a tremendous amount of learning that would be required for one to embark upon that journey. And this is, metaphorically speaking, what is referred to as self-power, of self-discipline, self-development. We have to rely upon ourselves to learn all of those skills, to build the raft, and then to set sail. And after all of that effort has been put forth, and we actually launch our rafts, and we cast our sails, then the wind fills our sails and takes us to the other shore. And all we have to do is just simply to steer the rudder. So the wind in this image is the other power. This is the grace of all the Buddhas. This is Amida Buddha, Amida Butsu, looking over me. So practice can, as it matures, as it deepens, practice can definitely have this feeling of stepping into something much greater than oneself. I very much have that feeling within my own practice, that I am more and more stepping into something that is much greater than myself, that is much more about service to others, and much less about the story of me. So this is the momentum of practice, where our cells begin to dissolve, certainly the grip of the story of me, what I want, it begins to dissolve. And as we make this journey, we can come to this realization that, you know, self, other, that this is all just simply mind-made. In fact, we are all deeply interconnected. Yes, we are selves. This is me, this is mine, this is who I am, and so much more. So I'd just like to leave you with one of my absolute favorite slogans from this Mahayana tradition, the path of self-surrender. And this comes from the Bodhisattva ideal. And it just goes like this. Helping self is helping others. Helping others is helping self. Helping self is helping others. Helping others is helping self. So that concludes this 4-week series. So I would like to thank all of you for your kind attention, and it's an honor and a delight to be here with you. So thank you all.
Thank you, Don Augusto. We have time for a few questions or comments. So let me invite people to...
I guess I was struggling a little bit about knowing with the capital K or the grace of the Buddha, and real and not real, but it provides comfort and direction, but we don't know exactly where it came from, what it is. We know it with a little k. I guess what I come up with, talking from David and culturally, is there's been so many different Buddhas and faiths and beliefs that are not based on what's real, what's knowing, and they come with a not only a personal comfort to it, but also action. Like Christianity or Muslim or Buddhist or the way people kind of worship somebody like a god or believe in them. It's more than just personal. It results sometimes in action and belief set, which from my point sometimes is not helpful and comforting. So that it almost seems a little tricky there. That's just my discomfort.
It's a very common discomfort, perhaps even universal. I mean, it's very interesting just to explore this question of what do I believe and why? It's actually a very, very deep question. So carry on with that exploration and let me know how it turns out.
That's one of the things that I've been so happy to hear, impressed with in the times I've heard you speak over here, is that you range over a wide range of Buddhist traditions. First time I really have heard in any level of depth, but anything about the Pure Land tradition of Japan. And you're giving me plenty of material to explore. I'm not sure. I want to thank you for that, because it's something that personally I haven't heard the range of experiences that you've shared with us. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Oswaldo.
I wanted to really thank you for the sort of cross-discipline approach, because I always identified with the Theravada tradition so much that I did feel sort of like getting sort of solipsistic and not really going out. And so you made me understand that there's a lot to be understood with the other traditions that would complement, and that even now in a tradition that I'm in offers a structure that is outside of myself, you know, and I always was trying to steer it so that it was myself, but now I see that that is not necessarily the only way that I could perceive it and go with it. So this has been very helpful for me.
Thank you.
Well, I guess we're out of time, but I'm sure you might want to hang around for a little bit. I hope so. I'd maybe answer a few more questions one-on-one. As I mentioned before, we at the next half hour, we have a social hour. We have a person that takes care of is our official host. David is doing the honors today. And I guess part of what I'm supposed to say at this point that I always tend to forget, but it's an important one, that we rely on our generosity of the Sangha members. We request a donation of $10 if you can afford it to sustain everything that you see around here, the rental of the space and some of the outreach we do to the community in various ways. And let me turn it over to, well, first of all, is there any announcements from anybody about anything important? We're missing the majority of the Sangha at the moment. They're having a retreat, so there's no announcements. So I'll turn it over to you.
I'm David. I'm the host today. enjoy the snacks and refreshments. If you have tea, rinse out the cup and put it in the sink. There's a sign-up sheet on the credenza there if you want to be on our email list. And I'll be walking around with the Dhamma bowl. Also, some people go out for lunch and kind of meet at the door around 12:30.
Okay, so then we close up our meeting with dedication of Prairie Dog.
Just one quick announcement. For next week, if I'm not mistaken, Larry Robinson is on the calendar to come. He has not been here for a couple of years now. He's a wonderful speaker, and he weaves his, you know, Buddhist Dharma with beautiful poetry. So if you've never, and it's not like he pulls something out and reads the poem, they're all like in his head. So if you have never experienced Larry Robinson, I urge you to come next week.
And he's a really interesting person.
Yeah, he's
been mayor of
Sebastopol.
Sebastopol.
Yeah. So he's really cool.
Quite all right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's do the dedication of merit.
Longer arms.
Yeah, it's a whole circle this time.
Okay.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month, and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.